Hey, well, it's a take three, and this is always a very exciting thing because it's everyone's new favourite feature.
Is it?
I think so.
Is it your new favourite feature?
Well, no, not really, because it asks awkward and embarrassing questions.
Which we quite like.
So it is, of course, time. This would be a good TV
show,
actually.
It's time.
For?
Take.
Three. Featuring the much-loved feature, Questions. Smestions.
Question smestions.
Very good. Jenny, aged 38 and a sixth. Good doctors.
Specific.
This Wednesday, the 7th of January, as you're recording the show, I'll be under... This Wednesday, the 7th of January. Okay, so we're...
Well, we're ahead of the 7th of December.
Okay.
I think she might mean the 7th of December, because I don't think the 7th of January is a Wednesday. Hang on.
I wonder if it's for future use.
No, the 7th of January is a Saturday. So she must mean the 7th of December.
And was that a Wednesday?
Well, it is. Today is the 7th of December.
Oh, yeah.
Today is a Wednesday.
Very good.
Are you with us?
I've lost track of time. This Wednesday, the 7th of December, as you're recording the show...
Yes.
I will be undergoing reconstructive shoulder surgery.
Okay.
Following a two-year battle with injury, including multiple dislocations and several ligament tears. A note to fellow secondary school teachers, don't try to break up fights between teenage boys if you have weak joints. I've been advised that I will be off work for up to 12 weeks.
Wow.
I now come to you both as literary men for film-adjacent reading to do in breaks between films and television. I've obviously read all of Mark's work. First of all, that's been crossed out. No reference to any of mine. But I suppose mine doesn't have any cinema. No, anyway.
Well, the movie doctors that we wrote together.
That's true. Anyway, I've recently enjoyed Helen O'Hara's Women vs. Hollywood.
It's a terrific book. It's a really terrific book, and she writes beautifully.
I have the new biography of Paul Newman sitting on my shelf, following the delight that was The Last Movie Stars documentary series, a potential take it or leave it. So I put it to you and my fellow brilliant listeners, what film-adjacent books should I be enjoying? Tinkety-tonk and all that jazz, formerly blue-haired feminist, University of Chichester's Woman of the Year 2017, and proud tenant of Teacher Corner. That's from Jenny.
Okay.
So first of all, Jenny, first thing to say is I hope the surgery has gone fantastically well.
Yes.
And that you are, as you hear this, already recovering and feeling quite chipper, but still off for 12 weeks.
I know. That is a...
Film-adjacent reading. First of all of your oeuvre has been established.
Yes.
What else?
Well... The books that I always suggest are, I don't know whether I mentioned this to you, but I got an email the other day that my BFI modern classic on The Exorcist is being translated into Belgian.
You mentioned it.
Which I think is whatever. So I always recommend When the Shooting Stops, which is...
Belgian isn't a language, of course.
No, Walloon. So, is it Walloon?
Walloon or Flemish, yeah.
Yeah, so... Well, it's being translated into one of the two of those.
For the enjoyment of the Belgians.
Exactly. Excellently, I can speak neither, so it doesn't matter.
Because they're at the World Cup, so they might as well be reading your books.
Precisely. So it's going to go on my shelf alongside the Japanese translation, which is my favourite one, the French translation, the English translation. I'll remind you that Alan Frank once said to me, are your film reviews available in English?
Good question.
Very funny.
There is a Taiwanese edition
of the Movie Doctors which is fantastic.
Which looks amazing.
Oh, honestly, the cover of the Taiwanese version of Movie Doctors is absolutely brilliant. It's sort of more fun to have. Okay, so When the Shooting Stops is a really full title, When the Shooting Stops, The Cutting Begins, a film editor's story by Ralph Rosenblum and Robert Caron. And if you want to understand... something about the art of editing, which we've talked about a lot on this program, that is the book that I will always go to. There is a brilliant book by Michael Dealey, which is called Blade Runners, Deer Hunters and Blowing the Bloody Doors Off. Or is it Deer Hunters, Blade Runners and Blowing the Bloody Deers Off? Blowing the Bloody Tears Off. And it is a really, really good book all about how Michael Dealey, you know, he was a film producer. He worked on things like Blade Runners, Deer Hunters and Blowing the Bloody Doors Off. He produced Blade Runner, obviously, also Deer Hunter, in which he tells the most brilliant stories about what an absolute arse Michael Cimino was. And, you know, worked with Michael Caine, worked with almost everybody. He produced Wicker Man and became sort of, you know, one of the villains of the Wicker Man story completely incorrectly. That's a really, really page-turning read. There is a fantastic book by Michel Simon called Final Cut, which is the book about how Heaven's Gate destroyed United Artists. There's a bit of a recurrent theme here, is that books about how absolutely terrible Boca directed Heaven's Gate.
Him.
I've gone blank. I'm having a senior moment. Michael Cimino. Sorry.
You already said Michael Cimino's an arse. I thought you must mean
someone
else.
Yeah, no, I know. Sorry. I suddenly was just looking at something else. I suddenly thought of Michel Simon, and I had a senior moment. There we go. Thank you very much. And now I'll get an email from somebody in Australia telling me that I've got cognitive impairment. Yes. That is a brilliant book, and it's really, really easy to read. A lot of people like Easy Rider's Raging Bulls. I think it's a little bit too much on the, and then they went to this party and took this drug, as opposed to this is how they actually changed cinema. There's a really brilliant book which has been recommended for me. Is it called Pictures of the Revolution? Let me just find the, what? Why are you doing?
Because you're looking something up on the internet.
Pictures at a Revolution. It's that one, isn't it? Okay, fine. Here is a book that I haven't read, but I've had it recommended to me, and I'm going to read it over the Christmas holidays. It is by Mark Harris, and it is called Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood. And I have been told that it is an absolutely rip-roaring read. So that is something that I would definitely recommend.
You know Hadley Freeman?
Yes.
Your friend?
Yes.
Didn't she write a book about 80s cinema?
Yes, and it's called Life Moves Pretty Fast.
There you go.
That's a great book.
I'm just chipping that one.
Yeah. And there's a new book. It's not cinema adjacent. There's a new collection of Marina Hyde's writings, which is absolutely terrific as well.
Katie in Dublin. I love taking...
Oh, If Chins Could Kill. If Chins Could Kill, which is a great book.
Katie in Dublin. I love taking all of your advice when it comes to film, but I have always been a scaredy cat. Sleepless nights, tears, and so have avoided horror films. As I've recently turned 30, I've decided it's time I grow up and branch out. Through my recent horror journey, I've realized that what I thought was a general sensitivity to scary things is actually demonophobia. I blame my Catholic primary school for this.
That would be right.
I am unreasonably scared of anything related to the possession or of the devil, although devil has been written with an asterisk instead of the word V.
Okay, fine, yeah.
Right? So, apart from those, I've enjoyed several horror films, including It Follows, Nope, A Quiet Place. Does that count? I think so.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Could the good doctor recommend any devil-slash-possession-free horror films to help broaden my horizons without causing too much sleep loss? So, very specifically, horror with no demons.
Well, okay. The Vanishing, the original Vanishing, not the terrible remake, but Spoorloos, which is one of the scariest films I have ever seen. And it doesn't have any demons in it. And it absolutely, I've never been so filled with a feeling of dread as watching that film, which incidentally...
I'm not sure that Katie in Dublin is going to be tearing towards seeing it.
But isn't that what you were asking for?
Yeah, but it sounds a little...
It's a 12 certificate.
Oh, okay. In which case, that's fine.
It's anything else? Bone chilling. I was going to say Onibaba, because that does have demons in it. So I know what you mean about the fear of possession. When I was a child, I mean, obviously this is Exorcist related, I was absolutely terrified about demonic possession. I thought the idea of demonic possession was so...
Jordan Peele's movies, would they be...
Yes, and that's a good... I mean, Get Out,
yes,
which is great. Although... There's,
well,
it's not a demonic possession thing, but there is a somebody, there's a soul body.
The kind of zombie movies are kind of, they're okay.
I mean, there's a demonic possession theme in so many things.
No, can't have any of it.
Okay. Spoorloos, the original version, not the terrible remake, by George Slaughter. Sluizer is one of the scariest films I have ever seen. It is a 12 certificate. It has no demons in it, and it scared the living daylights out of me.
Okay. Because if you've got demonophobia, that's obviously that thing, right? We're not going to...
Yeah.
Fine. So, Katie, let us know. I think she might have a sleepless night or two, but hey, you know. So, it's Sarah Campbell from Bucky, which you've already mentioned. this movie being named as critical choice for the greatest film of all time. Jan Dielman.
Jan Dielman, yeah.
Now, I know nothing about this, so I'm not wondering how on earth it can be the greatest film of all time.
So what happened is this. Science Sound does a poll every 10 years in which they ask critics to name their, you know, top 10 films. I contributed to one, I think, 10 years, maybe 20 years ago, but I didn't do it because I'm listed out and I've, you know, had enough. But for a long time, it was Citizen Kane. And then 10 years ago, Citizen Kane was taken from the top spot by Vertigo, which was actually very interesting because people always say, oh, you know, critics snobby, blah, 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 blah. And Citizen Kane had flopped at the box office when it first came out. Vertigo's a hit. And so in a way, it was a kind of triumph of popularism. Now, Jan Dielman, which is a film by Chantal Ackerman, has just gone in at number one. And people say, oh, well, you know, how? Where, what, you know, blah, blah, what Tokyo Story's been there? Because in the same way as the IMDb sort of top three, you know, it was always Shawshank Redemption, Godfather, it always worked like that. The sort of rate of change or rate of churn tends to be quite slow in terms of critical circles. The thing is, Jan Dielman didn't come out of nowhere. What I have noticed, weirdly enough, is in the last few years, a number of filmmakers that I've interviewed have started referring to Jan Dielman and saying, well, actually, I was influenced by it. I mentioned it in relation to Christine Vachon talking about Safe. Mark Jenkin, who's just made Ennis Main, which is out next year, said that he read a review of Ennis Main that went, well, clearly this is influenced by Jan Dielman. And he thought, oh, actually, yes, it probably is. Because like me and like everybody else, he saw Jan Dielman many years ago, but it is a film which kind of stays around. The significance of it is this. I did it on stage at the BFI on Monday, which I do every month. And it is a fairly cine-literate audience. I mean, you know, people come along to watch an hour and a half of me talking to, you know, filmmakers about films, and often quite obscure. I asked the audience, honestly, how many of you have seen Jan Dielman? And I think 12 people put their hand up in a room of a couple of hundred. So
that counts as not
yeah, many. So what this tells us is two things. Firstly, it's not a particularly, it was never a, you know, popular hit. As I mentioned, Christine Vachon said that if you said Jan Dielman to a financier, he'd say, I'm sorry, I don't want to make that movie because I know people love it, but no one went to see it. But it didn't come out of nowhere. It's been respected by critics for years, decades. And it is particularly true that in the last few years, it has kind of been particularly brought back into the canon. I mean, I think there are certain key individuals who've had a lot to do with putting it back in people's consciousness and getting it sort of shown again. And it is playing at the BFI as a result of this season, but it has, for a long time, people, I think, found it hard to get hold of. But it is a really very, very strong movie. I have no problem with it being number one because I think all lists are, you know, lists schmists. But the idea that somehow the whole thing was a fix and it all came out of nowhere, it didn't. If you had your ear to the ground, you could tell that there was a groundswell of people talking about the film. It just kept coming up, time and again. And the comparison that I made to you was, it's like when you were at Radio 1 playing pop tunes, and I remember you really loving, before I knew anything about him, Nick Drake, right?
Yeah.
And now everyone knows who Nick Drake is. But when you were first, you know, a big advocate of him.
But I didn't hear anything about him until, and he, you know, he had died decades before. Yes. I'd even played my first Nick Drake record.
Yes. But when you did, you said Nick, and I said, who's Nick Drake? And you kind of, you know.
Brad Pitt did a documentary for Radio 2 about the life of Nick Drake because he was a huge fan.
Right.
They probably paid him, you know, 150 quid. So I don't suppose he needed the money, Brad. But, the influence of, and actually, here's the great thing. He was terrible.
Brad's great, but he can't read a script. But it's just that fascinating thing is people go, well, I haven't heard of this movie, I haven't seen this movie, therefore why is it number one? If you do a cineast's poll, these things didn't come out of nowhere. It really was a surprise, but it didn't come out of nowhere. In the filmmakers' list of best films of all time, I think 2001 is now number one. But lists, schmists, you know, that's just how it works.
Marcus says, how honest can you or should you be if you have to do an interview with a filmmaker or an actor about one of his movies that you absolutely don't like? And best wishes from Hanover in Germany, which is where he is. Well, when we're doing this podcast and before when we were doing it on the radio, the sole basis that if we got someone on to talk about a film, The question is only, I think, will the audience be interested in this interview? Will they be interested in this film? The film might be a turkey. The film might not work at all, but will they be an interesting person and will it be an interesting conversation? And if the answer is yes, then you're thinking, okay, well, you know, well, let's pursue it. So, for example, the Jurassic Park movie this year was not great. Is Jeff Goldblum going to be an interesting interview? You absolutely bet your bottom dollar. And what I think of the movie, and I, you know, I enjoyed it more than most people, but, you know, I was just thinking there's lots to talk to Jeff Goldblum about. So I think it is possible, Marcus, from my point of view, it's possible to do an interview and not be dishonest about it. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to remember who was the person who came on to promote.
Jeremy Piven,
who came on to promote.
What's interesting is you knew what I was going to, I knew what you were going to say.
Yeah. So we've ended up talking about
Entourage.
And Jeremy Piven, and I remember in that interview, specifically bringing up the subject of the fact that a lot of people won't like it because of the way it's portrayed women and a bunch of other
things. Yeah, because it's misogynist rubbish.
Because I felt as though that had to be included. So occasionally there'll be a question like that. But in general, I think it's perfectly fair and decent to do an interview with an actor or a director and not to give my personal opinion about it, because that's not what I'm there for.
I think there's two things to say. Firstly, the amount of interviews you see, which begin with somebody going, I love the film, it's fantastic. When you think either you haven't seen it, not from you, from other interviews, you haven't seen it or you're just saying that. Okay, so I think you can never, ever do that. You are a brilliant interviewer. I'm not. I used to have this horrible thing about I had to tell everybody exactly what I thought because otherwise I felt it was dishonest. I had a couple of run-ins with directors in which I don't think it was useful. I don't think it was useful being in a room with somebody telling them what was wrong with the movie. My best experience was Lars von Trier when I say, I have to tell you, I hate Breaking the Waves. And he said, but do you really hate it? I said, oh, yeah, I really hate it. He said, but do you really detest it? I said, I absolutely loathe it. He said, good. If you just didn't like it, we wouldn't have got on. But if you absolutely hate it, we'll have stuff to talk about. And we weren't talking about that film. We were talking about Melancholia, which I did like. And it then turned out that he didn't like. So I hated the film that he was really proud of.
Why did you feel you had to tell him that you hated the film that you weren't there to talk about?
Because I had this kind of, this, you know, guilty thing, which was that you have to tell, you have to confess.
You don't.
I know, I've learned it now, and I've actually discovered that's one of the reasons why I'm not a good interviewer. But that was one of the very few occasions on which leading on that, you know, it's like saying to Leonardo DiCaprio, I forgive you for Titanic.
I do remember you saying that. He was somewhat flummoxed. I think there are very few occasions when an actor or a director has been turned down because the movie that they're promoting we know to be completely devoid of merit, or that the interview would not get over the primary hurdle of the fact that we've already given our opinion about their oeuvre.
Yeah, their oeuvre, exactly. But, I mean, you wouldn't interview somebody if you actually detested their work. Would you?
If I did test it all, no.
Because it's always
something come up. I genuinely think it wouldn't come up.
Yes.
Because we've, you know, everyone's worked together for long enough to think there's no point in suggesting you talk to that person about that because it would be too awful.
Yeah. Julian Sands isn't coming on the show anytime soon, is he?
I think Julian is a very fine man, don't you think? Unfairly maligned.
He probably is unfairly maligned.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've got a really long memory for being... Anyway, sorry.
Email is signed...
so petty.
I think it's Bita, but it's B-I-T-A. Anyway, it's signed Woman, Life, Freedom, which is, of course, iconic three words of this year. Bita says, I am a long-term listener, time-to-time emailer from Berlin, listening to Mark's review of Bones and All.
Yes.
Question came up, what is the deal...
What is the deal with
cannibalism films? I am a film/series lover with a broad taste and I'm open to almost any genre, although I find horror very challenging. I do realise that good horror movies always have a deeper meaning, a criticism of society, and so on. One semester film studies at the great University of Oklahoma and my great film professors taught me that. And I'm not even sure if Bones and All or Raw are classic horror movies, but I just don't get it. I am out of my depth with cannibalism. Which is not really an unfair thing to be out there. Hey. Maybe it's because I find it utterly disturbing and revolting. So I would like to ask, Mark, for a maybe academic explanation of this particular genre and why it seems to be in again. Can I just say, before we go any further, bizarrely, I had a conversation with Child 2 about cannibalism this week because it had come up in his work.
Child 2?
Child 3,
I think Child 2 is,
that's
a,
fine.
Is
I'm being
a
corrected.
Girl.
No, that's
quite, the last time
that's
I looked,
no,
Simon.
That's true. So Child 3...
I can't believe I'm correcting you on your own
thank
children.
You, thank you very much. They all kind of blur after a while. And I, because I mean,
okay, can I just say, having a conversation with Child 3 about cannibalism makes a lot more sense.
It's the kind of thing that comes up in his work. And I was saying, I just said, where does the word cannibalism come from? And as a result of just doing some prep on this, I think the whole word, the word cannibal is problematic. This is this isn't, well, I don't know. I'm just saying, I'm suggesting that it is.
Okay.
Because the word cannibal comes from Christopher Columbus's rendition of the Caribs' name for themselves. So he called them caniba. And cannibal now means...
flesh eater.
Savage. It means savage. So a Carib is a native of Central America, formerly of the Caribbean.
Right.
Okay. So Christopher Columbus's rendition of their... So basically, it's a play on their word.
Okay.
So it's the way Christopher Columbus said the word Carib. He said caniba, and from caniba we get cannibalism.
I didn't know that.
I mean, clearly, it's not an everyday topic, and it's not, you know, but...
No, it's interesting. I didn't know.
And here's my favourite fact.
Go on.
The Old English. So before cannibalism,
yes,
there was a word for a cannibal.
Which was?
Well, you spell it S-E-L-F.
Self.
A-E-T-A.
Eater.
Self-eater. That was the Old English word for a cannibal, a self-eater.
Until somebody said, you've really got to come up with a better word.
Yeah, so cannibal. Okay. Anyway, so there you go. So we drifted somewhat, but I just thought that was quite interesting.
Okay. Can I just say, on
What is it? Says, what is it?
Okay. So it's two things. One of them is that it's one of the great taboos. Cannibalism is a great taboo, and there are obviously very good natural reasons for that to be a great taboo, because cannibalism, in terms of the ongoing growth of the species, is generally not thought to be a very good idea.
Yes.
And, it's not. In terms of what it means when somebody says, I just don't get cannibalism, and, as we know, there are Hollywood actors who apparently do.
I've forgotten that. Are there?
Yeah, you know who I'm talking about.
I don't.
Yeah, you do.
Do I?
I'm not going to say it, but...
Oh, I do remember you saying that.
Yeah, fine, okay. Anyway.
Are you saying that the name of the person that you've just written down is into cannibalism?
That's what the text message is implied. Although maybe in a fantasy environment. Anyway. The point is, there are, in relation to the email, said, I just don't get cannibalism, okay? The best explanation I ever heard of the thing about what, when people are talking about cannibalism, why it is that it has a thing at all. You know that phrase, if you're a grandmother or something and you see a cute child, I could eat you up, okay?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a weird thing to say.
Well, it's now that you're thinking of it in context of...
No, I've always thought it's a weird thing to say.
Okay. Well, a lot of people don't think it's a weird thing to say. A lot of people think it's a completely natural thing to say because it's part of common parlance. Oh, I could eat you up.
No.
No, it doesn't matter whether you think it is or not. It is part of common parlance, okay? It is a thing that people say. It's, and the thing about, I've seen, celebrities. There was a very famous interview. It was a Parkinson interview in which some very famous actress was talking about, she has children, and about, baby's flesh that you almost want to sink your teeth into it. And the audience weren't going, oh my God, they weren't revolted. They were kind of going, that I want to eat you up thing. That's, I think, what's at the heart of the idea of cannibalism in art, is that on some really weird, deeply messed up...
We all want to be it.
We understand on some level, although we're revolted and repulsed and all the rest of it, there is some part of us that goes, yes, but... And that's the way that all horror works, is that it... It's not just something that terrifies and revolts you. It's also something that on some level you kind of get it, and that's what really disturbs you. I'm not saying, I don't want to eat anybody up.
Is that right?
Just to be absolutely
just
clear.
To be reassured.
And I've never used the phrase.
I'm the closest one here, you know, so that's
reassuring. But what I'm saying is, so the reason that cannibalism comes around a lot in horror is, one, because it's an absolute taboo, and secondly, because it's an absolute taboo that everybody on some level gets and wishes they didn't.
Thank you very much for the question, Beta. Last week, Nicola asked for help identifying the source of the quote, "We'll meet one day in some celestial bar."
Yes.
And I Googled it. Until it died, and no
Googled
one.
Until Google died.
Yeah. Tom says, "Hi, chaps. I believe the celestial bar the listener was referring to might be a With Nail and I reference. There is an in memoriam script at the end of the film dedicated to director Bruce Robinson's friend Vivian, where he says, 'If there is a bar in heaven, I will find you there,' and Keats is serving the drinks." I mean, I have to say, Tom, that I think you're pushing that. But anyway,
yeah, I don't think that's right. Ed, I mean, that may be right, but I don't think that's what the line is.
Ed from Ruffy. Pretty sure the listener's half-remembered lyric, "We'll meet one day in some celestial bar," is in fact, "I believe we'll meet one day, say hello in some astral bar."
Oh, okay.
And it's from the song "Love Me and Leave Me" by the band The Seahorses. This also fits the 1996 to 1997 period.
Okay.
With a reference to it first being
genius.
Thought to be a space
genius.
Song.
Genius.
Seahorses singer Chris Helm is currently touring to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Do It Yourself album from which the song is taken.
Okay.
And that...
That sounds convincing to me.
That sounds about right. Because the jump from space to seahorses is not far, and that quote is certainly a lot closer than the one that we had from With Nail. So maybe we've sorted that.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
I think we're just going to do one more.
Okay.
Because
you are all talked out.
I am all talked out. name withheld. Okay. Dear Dad 1 and Dad 2, it's been a bit of a week in our house, and I still can't believe I'm writing this down. But my partner and I found out we're expecting our first child. So congratulations.
Congratulations.
And the reason the name is withheld is because we haven't told our family.
Oh, okay, fine. Okay. Sorry, okay, fine.
So there's anything bad.
No, it's thank you for, because it's always good to know that.
We are absolutely over the moon.
Good.
And perhaps as some sort of coping mechanism, my brain immediately went to films. From a young age, I've learned all my life lessons through film. The Lion King taught me you can't change the past. Shawshank told me to get busy living or get busy dying. And don't bring dinosaurs back from extinction, even if you can. I mean, you kind of know that. As dads of various numbers, I wanted to pick your brains with a question and a schmestion. Schmestion first. Looking back, what would be your best bit of advice for a soon-to-be dad? Second question. What film should we prioritize over the next 9 months that will get us prepped for parenthood as best as possible?
Okay, well, that's for you. That's absolutely yours.
I don't think I have the emotional strength to do Boyhood again. Hello to Jason Fairport and Stephen Fry, name withheld. So I'll go first. So you've actually answered the second question, because the answer is parenthood. Because when you've got kids, it'll be too painful to watch. So watch Parenthood. Laugh. It's a very funny film. It's a very profound film. Ron Howard film. We talked about it when he was on the program for 13 Lives. But you won't be able to watch it when you are a parent.
Yeah.
So watch it now while you can enjoy
and
it.
And also because it begins with when you go in into third and you need to do a third diarrhea.
Which is great. Not on the soundtrack, unfortunately.
And is it not?
No. And the schmestion, what bit of advice would you give for a soon-to-be dad? I would say, there is no such thing as quality time, because everyone makes a big thing. You've got to have quality time with your kids. Quality time comes from quantity time. You don't get the quality. You can't just go, right, I've got 40 minutes. We're going to have some quality time. Tell me something. It never, ever works like that. Quantity time gives you the quality time. So you just have to put in the hard yards. They would be that's the only advice that I've got.
That's brilliant.
So the question is the movie to watch between now and birthday.
Well, I'd say, as far as the movie watching thing is concerned, watch everything because
you have no time.
Precisely. I remember, yes. I said this before, I remember leaving the pub quiz on the Sunday night before child one was born and saying to Ian, who ran the pub quiz, see you next week. No, you won't.
No.
Many years later, I bumped into him and it was like, he said, he knew as I was going out the door, he's not coming back
Do you remember we got an email from someone who had developed a way of going out to the movies on their own because the child had arrived and they put the pajamas on underneath their clothes because when they came back, it just made it easier not to disturb their partner because they were already in their pajamas. Yeah. Anyway, that's how difficult it is. Okay.
And the thing about what, you know, what piece of advice I would give a father.
A soon to be dad.
I mean, the advice from my own life is this. Your partner probably knows better than you do how to manage this. And I don't know how universal this is. The thing that I learned more than ever is listen to what they say. They're probably right. When you are more tired than you have ever been and thinking, I can't think straight because I haven't slept in forever. Somehow, there is something that your partner, it's like a superhuman power, which is not quite as derailed. And listen to them. They know what they're talking about. And if there is any disagreement between you and them, they're right. Do what they say.
You have been instructed. I'd say hello to all the people at Radio 1 who I worked with when I was a new dad. And they would come in and they were really, really super tired because they'd been a clubbing and a party at the discotheque. And I was tired because children and everything. And I would just say, yeah, this is a different kind of tired. I'm tired, you're tired, but you're tired because you've gone out and had a good time. And they will now be parents, all those people. So I'm just saying, you know the way you're feeling now? It was that. Yeah. That's what I was talking about.
One other bit of advice I'd give you is if everything else fails, walk round and round in a circle in the living room, holding your new bundle of joy, singing Jonathan Richman's I'm a Little Dinosaur for hours. It works.
So thank you very much, Steve, for the questions and the specials. There's loads that we haven't got to, but keep them coming in and we'll do as many as we can. Correspondence@curbetamayor.com. Thank you for listening.